75% of the hotel's rating is based on service, and 25 is based on facilities, because really there's a lot of beautiful places out there. But what will really make your experience stand out is the service, is the people who help you. Those are the components that really make a stay transformative.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Global Wellness Summit podcast. I'm your host, Kim Marshall, co-founder of Swell Public Relations and a wellness storyteller. Speaking of the Global Wellness Summit, here's just a friendly reminder that this year's summit will now be held November 30th through December 3rd in Boston, Massachusetts, which happens to be not just the city of cheers and baked beans, but also a health, innovation, education, and biotech powerhouse of a city. Tel Aviv will now be the location for GWS 2022. This year's hybrid conference, which means it will have both in-person and virtual attendees, will be held at the five-star Encore Boston Harbor, a Wynn resort. Speaking of exciting destinations and hotels, today we'll be discussing a topic that is close to many of our hearts and something many of us have desperately missed over the past year and some months, and that is travel. We'll be talking about how travel may be changed forever and maybe even rebooted for the better because of the pandemic. You know, travel is an industry where I've happily spent most of my career, and today we get to speak to two of the leading voices in the travel field. First, we'll talk with Elaine Glusak, the popular Frugal Traveler columnist from none other than the New York Times. Elaine actually researched and wrote this year's Global Wellness Summit trend, the Travel Reset. In the second half of the show, we'll be going to the other end of the travel spectrum as we speak to Jennifer Kester, executive editor of Forbes Travel Guide, that, as you probably know, is all about luxury travel. These ladies have been covering hotels, food, and destinations for nearly two decades. Can you say dream job? Elaine is an award-winning writer based in Chicago who's written for other outlets like Afar, AARP, National Geographic Traveler, Condé Nast Traveler, and Travel and Leisure. She's definitely on the front lines of the industry, and she's also a goldmine of smart travel hacks. Jennifer's ForbesTravel.com and Instagram pages are a colorful journey through the best of the best in hotels, chefs, cities, and cruises. She'll share some of her favorite places, especially spas, as well as some ways to add a touch of luxury to your next trip. She'll even explain how a hotel or resort is judged worthy of the coveted Forbes five stars. So let me ask you, did you take traveling for granted before COVID? What is your responsibility as a buyer of travel? Can you actually leave a place better than you found it? We'll be discussing this and more as we wander with a purpose through the Global Wellness Summit's 2021 trend, the Travel Reset. Elaine, are you there? Welcome.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Kim. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we need to hear from you because we're tickled to share with our listeners that you researched and presented one of the trends that the Global Wellness Summit put out for 2021, and that was called the Great Travel Reset. So first, before we jump into that, I want to ask how you got this great gig. Your LinkedIn says that you've been specializing in food and travel for over 26 years. And I know I used to be a writer, but I'm in PR. So I know anyone can start a blog and buy Instagram followers and say they're a travel influencer. But I'll just let you know right now, you've hit the big time. How did you get there?
Oh, God. Dedication, persistence, obsession. I don't know. It's sort of, you know, I think any journalist will tell you, you have to be pretty Teflon in this business. So when I got into journalism, I desperately wanted to do travel, but it's very competitive. So I honed my skills writing in other areas. I wrote everything you can imagine, you know, fashion, fitness, lifestyle, news. And I even wrote for a small Italian paper. And then gradually I was able to sort of move over to travel once I gained some more experience and expertise in the field. I have to say, it was just a matter of just, you know, I'm a dog with a bone.
Oh, what a good bone. And really, big congrats. I just read on Twitter at Elaine Glusak that you won Journalist of the Year, the Lowell Thomas Travel Journalist of the Year Award, another award by the Society of American Travel Writers. And the judges recognize your deeply reported and meticulously contextualized pieces. So, which brings us to the report you did for GWS. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of that. But first of all, we know tourism was brought to its knees during the pandemic. But before that, you reported that tourism accounted for more than 10% of the world economy. But am I right, Elaine? Was tourism the number one employer in the world before the pandemic?
Not necessarily. It's one of the world's biggest economies. It accounted for 330 million jobs before the pandemic globally. That's one in 10 jobs worldwide. So super big. And also to add some context to that number, it's a really important employer of women. Almost half the jobs in tourism are held by women. It's also a very important economic driver for countries seeking to get out of poverty. And of course, the impacts have been severe. In the US alone, they lost nearly $500 billion in spending last year. And unemployment in that industry alone was something around 70%.
Yeah.
So it's an impact.
Yeah, for the Leader live cast that we did on Instagram Live for Global Wellness Summit, we interviewed the head of Virtuoso, the head of Forbes Travel Guide. And I'm telling you, it was like a funeral, but not really, because we knew there would be light at the end of the tunnel. So continuing that vein, we know that before the pandemic, over-tourism was a problem in many areas, the complete opposite, like Barcelona, Venice, even Machu Picchu. But your report, The Travel Reset, says that when it comes to tourism, the pandemic pause could even be looked at as a needed break that rebooted travel for the better. Why do you think so?
You know, I think when you're flooded with visitors like that, it's hard to carve the time out to plan. The pandemic gave those destinations and attractions the time that they needed to figure out how to do things better. Literally, no one ever expected that, you know, that the turnstiles would stop at Disney, for example.
Right, right.
And they needed to figure out how to manage crowds and space out visits. And this was true, of course, before the pandemic, but then the need for social distancing only hastened that development. So if you think about it, think about like museums, for example. They got really clever in ticketing and time tickets and advanced purchase entry. And then you saw things like that at Disney and other places. So I think that technology has been a really great boon to solving some of the over-tourism problems. And that I think you'll see continuing in Kyoto, Japan, for example. They're piloting a system that helps attractions like temples, you know, which are free, but they're trying to get people to get a ticket in advance so that when you go there, when you're allowed to go there, you're going to have this great experience because it's going to be very tranquil and very meditative as it should be instead of being overrun. So it's a win-win for everybody. It doesn't like overrun the temple. And then you, the traveler, will have a better experience yourself. So technology, having the time to develop those systems has been useful. When we talk about places like Barcelona and Venice, a lot of over-tourism in those port cities are linked to cruises.
Cruises, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So cruise traffic is, the problem with cruise traffic is those visitors come for a day and they use a lot of services, but they don't necessarily contribute much to the economy. So if you're staying in Venice and you're staying overnight, you know, you're paying a hotelier, you're employing somebody, you're probably dining locally. You're not doing that when you're on a cruise. So Venice has made some steps during the pandemic. They recently banned large cruise ships from docking near the city.
Wow.
Yeah. And they're building some cruise docks a ways out from the Venetian Lagoon. That's not going to fully take care of over-tourism there, but they're working on other steps. They're calling for the regulation of short-term rentals and proposing fines for people who litter. Cruise tourism isn't fully back. So a lot of those solutions remain to be seen. And I think they're still working on it.
Right. And then I even read where places like Hawaii, where I used to live, my son now lives, there used to be a lineup going up Diamond Head in the morning, but now they're trying to really take a breath and focus on cultural and historical tours instead of just Mai Tais and tiki torches, right?
Absolutely. Oh, it's so funny that you mentioned Diamond Head. I was there December 2020, 2 months before the pandemic, and I, I had been there like 10 years before. And I remember saying to my son, hey, let's go climb Diamond Head at sunrise. It'll be great. And I had done it before and there were just like local runners doing it. And this time I went and it was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea, by the bus loads and all of the stairways that go up Diamond Head, which you probably know, were just like lined with people all pointing their cameras towards the sunrise. And we kind of got to the top and said, okay, well, no, we're leaving.
That's not really an experience. So you mean December 2019?
Sorry, did I say 2020?
Because I was like, you are really something if you did that.
Yeah, it was just 2019 before the pandemic. Yeah.
But you know, I have to say, I was able to go as the opposite of that in late March of 2021 to the Big Island. And what a delight, because as everyone knows, there's a lot of breeze in Hawaii and most everything is open air. The airports are open air, restaurants are open air, a lot of houses are open air. And of course, the vaccination and the testing was so nice that you really felt a sense of relief that, you know, they had this under control. So, you know, what a ray of light. Now, further on the topic of that, you talked about in August of 2020, there was an article in the New York Times you wrote called regenerative travel. You kind of coined a new phrase. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So regenerative travel is a step beyond sustainable travel. It seeks to balance the impact. So like, sustainable travel does too, but it also wants to give back or do some good or leave a place.
So hold on. What is sustainable travel? We should ask that first. So build the building blocks, right?
Absolutely. So sustainable travel, just basically clean up after yourself, right? Don't leave any lasting impact. You know, leave only footprints, take only pictures, that kind of thing. Really speaking broadly, you are being a careful steward of nature and also mindful of communities and your impact on communities and lessening both of those. So sustainable travel just basically says, don't muck it up. Regenerative travel says, okay, travel is really powerful. People spend a lot of money traveling. What if this could be harnessed to something where you're actually running the battery and making places better for the people that live there or the nature that lives there, whatever it is. So you're practicing sustainable, you know, travel principles like not using single-use plastics, eating locally and buying locally. But regenerative really harnesses that power of travel to improve the lives of the people living there. I will say that it's a really nice goal and a lot of people are thinking about it. It's in practice, it's hard.
Hard to do.
Yeah, I'll give you one example of a place that I think is doing really well. And it's a resort in Mexico called Playa Viva. And it's 12 rooms on 200 acres in this small town on the Pacific. But the town is very integral to the resort experience. So you sort of enter the resort through the town. You're eating the produce raised by the town folk. The town folk are the stewards of the turtle sanctuary that you can visit there. 2% of your room rate goes back to the town to pay for things like education and other. Wow. And you're encouraged to like be in the town as much as you are at any of the resort facilities. So it's this symbiotic relationship that regenerative travel is trying to harness.
Wow. You know, somehow it's so heartwarming to me to see how important communities are. There's like a mutually beneficial relationship starting to develop between resorts and their surrounding communities. What are you seeing? Is it unique or are a lot more people using local craftsmen for like the dishes used in the restaurants or the decor in the rooms or even donating to local nonprofits?
No, I think that's a super big trend. And I think we have seen that for a while and it's a wonderful trend because wherever we want to go, I mean, most travelers, when they go somewhere, they want to feel like they are there. They're in that. And I remember when I first went to Hawaii so many years ago, I remember going to a Ritz-Carlton and I'm like, this Ritz-Carlton could be in Chicago. And
Yep. I remember that one.
And now even the Ritz-Carltons have, you know, like local decor and local craft or, you know, commission local artists to do their artwork. And in fact, I would say luxury hoteliers like that have really been great in sustaining a lot of local artisans and craftsmen. So that's been a really wonderful development.
I worked a lot with Tahiti, 12 years, in fact, and I'll never forget the hotels. That was the Bora Bora Nui, and it was a Hilton at the time, the Hilton Moorea. The owner's wife was Tahitian, a stunningly beautiful Tahitian woman, and she cared about the landscape. So she'd get out there and make sure the turtles from Tahiti were used and the right plants. And she also just nurtured local artists, contests at the art schools and showcased their work in the rooms. It was really exciting. So what about, you mentioned cruises, what about the cruise industry? Are they learning? Are we seeing any positive steps there?
I think that they're being forced to learn. I mean, I had one major cruise executive who's very green, by the way. I mean, but you know, he basically said, if consumers demand it, the cruise industry will respond. And so it's sort of all consumer led. We as buyers of travel need to insist that, you know, they use clean energy and have other environmentally supportive systems. You know, Virgin Voyages is launching, they meant to launch right around March 2020. And so they've been putting that off until this summer, I think. And they have a ship that's going to be the greenest out there. We're making steps. If I could advise anyone to, you know, if you want to do a cruise that's more sustainable, choose the smallest ship you can afford. Less of an impact.
That's a very good tip. Now, what about the safari industry? I was able to go to Tanzania. What a dream come true. I swear to God, I almost flew myself there. I was so happy to go. And it was a luxury tent safari, mobile tent safari. And the gentleman had been leading safaris for almost 30 years in Africa. He loved the place. And he was personal friends with two specific tribes. One were Click-speaking people. The other were the Berber tribe, I believe. We really hung out with the people. The Click-speaking tribe didn't even live in huts. They just lived out in the wild. And we sat with the kids. My son videoed them, and they all had their hands on his shoulder and leaning forward, doing cat's cradle, but they'd never seen themselves on video before. I mean, what a life-changing experience. But I think you wrote about a good example in the safari industry.
Yeah, I mean, safaris, you know, they've been really important in many, many parts of Africa in actually conserving the landscape they're going to visit. You know, if there's such a thing as an extraction economy, which is when you're taking things away from the environment, like poaching, like mining, or a more regenerative environment where you're actually supporting the environment through your economic activity. And that's what tourism has done for safaris in Africa. They've created conservation preserves that wouldn't be there otherwise. And they've given a lot of communities a new way to make a living, right? You don't poach. You can now become stewards of the environment, show people around. They'll be really happy. A lot of safari operators have done a really good job. And, you know, many of them will just basically adopt local communities, train their people, fund their schools. So again, it's sort of a win-win for everybody. They're conserving the environment, but you're also having a great experience. The animals win. The ecosystem wins. Marriage of all. Yeah.
Now, I read on one of the, on your bio, I think it was, I think when you won another award from SATW, they said, you're the kind of gal that would just pull up to the bar and talk to a local and really dig your nails in, you know, to know the community. What do people mean in your travels, connecting with people?
Everything. So I have to say, and that was what I was really worried about. I used to tell people that during the pandemic, I would tell people, hey, you know, my job is talking to strangers. And I don't think strangers don't want to talk to strangers right now. You know, it was during the pandemic and I was worried that I'd go back on the road and no one would want to talk to me anymore because, you know, like we'd be breathing on each other. But, you know, vaccination, I went out and did my first trip. I was fully vaccinated on May 5th. I left on May 6th. And I did a four night trip in Arizona. And three of those nights I got invited to parties. And I was like, all right, this is great. Call back. But people bring so much to think about it. You know, everyone loves to hear a voice in a story, right? Stories are voices. So I think if I don't have like rich characters in my story, it's just not interesting to me. I like to meet the people as much as the place. And believe me, I love places. I'm very much a nature outdoor person, but people really bring it to life.
Well, it just reminds me when I was so, so lucky to bring four journalists to Easter Island. I don't even know how I finagled that one. And we were led around for the, I don't know, 5 days or 7 days by this big, hulking, would-be scary guy. He said his ancestors were headhunters. He was the biggest teddy bear. We laughed. We cried. We did ATVs and one of our members just kept hitting trees. You know, she just kept going right for the tree. We laughed, and he would get all teary-eyed laughing. We got up at sunrise to see, you know, the colors in the sky over the Maori statues. We had so many moments. And actually, when we left at the airport, he cried. And we're like, Is this the big warrior guy? We don't even know. We'll never, ever forget him. So yeah, people are everything. Tell me now, let's see, where were we? And I was so busy thinking back to my wonderful time in Easter Island. Have you been there or no?
Have in Easter Island. And I have to say, that is a very good example of where people are so important. As you said, your guides. I remember I went to a church on Easter Island. Someone had told me the singing is amazing because it marries sort of these missionary, you know, these religious songs to like the local style of singing. And it was just an unforgettable, like ringing, soulful experience. That wasn't Easter Island heads. That was Easter Islanders living today. So, it's wonderful.
Well, so our listeners know, this chunk of Polynesia is like a 5-hour flight from Santiago, Chile. I mean, it's so far in the middle of nowhere, and it's a blend of Polynesia and Latin cultures. I never seen anything like it. My husband's from Cuba. I spent time in Hawaii, Tahiti. This place blew my mind. Okay, that's just one of the places in the world. But speaking of, you know, having these goals, what do you think a bucket list and purposeful travel, what do they have to do with the new trends?
I think people spent a lot of the pandemic thinking about their bucket list and thinking about what was important, you know, what was really important to them. I think a lot of people initially are going to make trips, the important trips are really going to be about connecting with people they love. Then I do think there's going to be a surge in sort of like the big ones. Let's go hit the big ones, because listen, we took it for granted that we could travel anytime. And now we know the whole world can experience a pandemic, and maybe we're all shut in again. So I think you'll see that. But I do think, as you mentioned, I think purposeful travel is much more important now, or more front of mind for a lot of people. Again, I think it was just having a chance to reflect, think about their impact on the world. You know, you make a choice about how you do things, right? You can ask, is my dollar staying in this local community, or is it going back to some multinational corporation? And you're being both sustainable and purposeful in thinking about it. I guess you could put that together and just call it conscious travel. I think people are more aware of their impacts. And I do think that the pandemic was a great lesson in that. I think we all learned about sustainability through the pandemic, when we saw like our neighborhood pizzerias and bookstores suffering, you know, and we all realized, hey, if I go there and I spend my local dollar there, as opposed to like Domino's, I'm really helping this local family, you know, and this local family is then like renting this shop on my street. So my street is vibrant. And we all saw how this makes life better for everybody.
Oh, yes.
Everybody has a sustainable mindset coming out of the pandemic.
Oh, that's so cool. Now, speaking of mindsets, I also saw a term you use called tentative tourism in the study. What is that, and how did it help make the hotel the destination in many cases?
Tentative tourism, as I described it, is really the hesitancy that we saw around us and still see. I mean, as vaccination rates grow, people are becoming more comfortable moving around. Obviously, they're leaving their homes, they're leaving their cities, they're leaving their states. But, you know, there's uneven vaccination rates around the world and continued border restrictions and travel requirements. International travel is still really crimped. But I think it's been a great opportunity for hotels, even if it's a staycation, to really make themselves the reason for the escape. People realize, like, I got to go somewhere that's not under my control. I really need a break. And so we saw hotels doing like pop-up retail or museum exhibits, or there's a London hotel this summer that's doing a tea with a mini horse who's really famous on Instagram. I mean, it's like, you can surprise and delight a guest, you know, who doesn't have to leave to have that. Then it's a win-win for the hotelier, you know, and for the guest who maybe isn't ready to go far and wide in their explorations. They're still sort of coming out of their pandemic shell.
Yeah.
And that just makes the hotel that much more interesting. So I think that has been, I think hoteliers have been really creative in responding to that.
Stepping up to the plate. Yeah, because you do feel like if you stay in the bubble of the hotel, at least they know what they're doing. You're not out there on your own. You know, in this episode, we'll also be talking to Jennifer Kester from Forbes Travel Guide. And we're talking about the world of luxury travel in 2021. But you, Elaine, are a contributor to the New York Times Frugal Traveler column. It's called Tips for How to Navigate the World on a Tight Budget. That's kind of the yin of her yang. But what are some of the lessons any average traveler could learn from your research on traveling frugally?
Jen's a friend of mine, so I'm glad you have her on with me. It's great. So, you know, I define frugal as smart. And I actually think that I write for 99% of travelers when I'm writing that column. I mean, I think everyone likes to save money and everyone wants good value when they spend their money. And I don't care what income level you're at. That's just true. And so I feel that I often tell people that in saving money, you can actually have a better experience. I mean, there's a time to take a cab or an Uber, but there's also real fun to be had taking a tuk-tuk in Thailand or riding the Brown Line train where I live in Chicago. It's elevated and it loops the loop. You know, it's good, cheap fun, that one with the locals. So I think that if you look at it as I'm going to jump right in the pool and I might save some money too, well, that's kind of fun. You might actually choose to do that. Did you want some tips, Kim?
I do, because, you know, so I would just say things like book your ticket, not on the weekend days, but what do you say? You know everything about it.
And I have to say, I have 1,000 hacks. If you go to, you know, the Times Travel site online, you know, hacks for getting a hotel rate and hacks for booking, you know, airline tickets, all that stuff. But I would just say generally, I don't think that you have to sacrifice style or comfort or taste to travel frugally. Sometimes it's just about picking a different season, like shoulder season, or a different day to fly, like Tuesday or Saturday. I always say, think like a contrarian. Go when and where people are not going, and you'll save. And guess what? You'll probably be the first one there. You know, like if you're thinking about Croatia, check out Montenegro. It's the same coastline. It's less crowded. It's way cheaper. So there's just a lot of ways that you can make it fun and not restrictive, I would say.
So Elaine, where can we look this up again? Give us a way to Google your tips, because we need your hacks.
Oh, sure. Well, nytimes.com/travel is the travel section of the New York Times. You could also just Google my last name and you'll probably get a lot of hacks on saving money, booking things.
Well, it's so much fun. It's almost like a game too. I have a friend who's completely wealthy, but we wanted to get away. So when we went to Hawaii, we stayed with friends, and she doesn't normally stay in people's houses, but we just had so much fun. We bonded with them even more, and they knew the ins and outs. They took us on trails and hiking experiences that we'd never have, you know? So it's that sort of thing. But speaking of the luxury traveler, I was able to interview that crazy, brilliant architect, Bill Bensley. Isn't he nuts? For the Global Wellness Summit Instagram Live series. He's so nuts. He's the best architect in the world, I think. But anyway, he certainly stayed busy during the pandemic. And hotel architect. Can you tell our listeners a little about what you know about the human zoo he's designing in China?
Yeah. I mean, this could only come from the fertile mind of Bill Bensley. I think it's like a 2,000 acre nature preserve, essentially. And it'll have something like 7 hotels. And I think 2,000 rooms-ish. And then you as a guest actually explore the preserve by taking one of several trains. You can do a day trip through the preserve or you can do an overnight. And the animals in the preserve represent 3 continents. I think it's Asia, Australia, and Africa, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. So you are confined, human, in the train or in your hotel, and the animals roam freely within their continental confines. And then you go and visit them. And I have to say, like, it sounds a little bit nuts, but Bill Bensley is a true champion of the environment and of nature. So I trust that this will be both super tasteful and have a very light impact on the land and on the animals.
I know. It is so encouraging to really look at his work. He has so many 6-star properties. It's nuts. And then he always wins, you know, top hotel in the world by Condé Nast Traveler. Help me. But anyway, speaking of that sort of luxury, I know in the report you said you talked to somebody from Marriott who talked about a new class of traveler called a purposeful luxurian. What's that?
So I think when we talk about a purposeful luxurian, we're really talking about a luxury traveler who's just much more conscious and aware of their impacts, both social and environmental, and, you know, wants to explore the world, but wants to do it in the right way, wants to have great experiences, but wants to make sure that whatever they're doing is also benefiting the environment and the local community. So in that sense, I really love the fact that Marriott is thinking about how to make travel super meaningful and not just about, you know, martinis with gold flecks on the rim, you know, making a luxury experience something that's meaningful and memorable for you and helpful, you know, and benefits the community.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, you sit around a cocktail party, you tell someone, what was your best experience? What was the thing? And I dare you to find someone who isn't about connecting with nature or people or something that's just not typical, right? That has a sense of purpose. So you prepared the research for this travel reset trend, right? But that was done in late 2020, I would guess. So how have you seen this travel scene changing in the past few months when now many parts of the U.S. are about 70% vaccinated? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I am seeing a lot of travel. And I have to say, like, the rebound was really sharp to a certain extent and probably a little faster than I expected. But of course, the vaccinations have been, you know, initially went really, really fast. And we started to see around spring break that people were really coming back. You know, we were seeing full planes and shortages of rental cars. That said, you know, we're still a third off in terms of overall numbers in the United States. And a lot of that has to do with the business travel, business and events, conventions. They're not projected to come back for another year or so. That will, you know, keep things under wraps. But I do think that a lot of things that I wrote about in the report are still really valid. We're still seeing people are very interested in nature, in going places that are wild and restorative in their own ways, like Alaska, Hawaii. Here in the United States, the national parks are just selling out like crazy, which is kind of a staple for summer. But they did so much, much more rapidly, and visitation has been much higher in the pandemic, especially in off-season months. So those things are continuing. And my fear, my greatest fear, is that we'll forget about sustainability as we rush back to having fun.
I know, but
I was just reading a survey from Deloitte yesterday that said that 60% of millennials and Gen Zers really care about sustainability and want to make that the focus point of their travel. So I think if we get that those newer generations coming up and really demanding it, that's going to be great for the entire industry. So that gives me hope.
Me too. You know, but what doesn't give me hope is when I keep reading these reports about unruly people on airplanes, and it just breaks my heart. So I saw that a couple of airlines were saying, please, passengers, try to help us defuse the situation or do what you can. What do you think? Do you think that will calm down?
You know, I have flown many times now since vaccination, and I've actually found that people have been kind of nice. You know, I saw people helping each other with their luggage. Like, in the pandemic, I flew once, and that was, people were very tentative, and you know, the airlines made an announcement when we landed, you know, please leave row by row. You felt like you were at a wedding where everyone gets
yeah.
And people were really respecting that. And I this last trip I took, people were not, they still jump up, but they weren't rushing up too. And they were helping each other with their luggage. I've had great flights. So I really think, you know, those things make the news, but I do think they're the outlier.
Yeah, I think you're right. And really the joy of getting out there. I mean, I get to fly to Phoenix this weekend and it's such a big deal to me. It's not even that far from me in LA. And I'm like, yippee, I get to go somewhere. But anyway, just for fun, as we wrap up, I think our listeners would really love to know some fun facts about Elaine Glusak, since you've been so many places around the world. And what, you know, what has kept you so comfortable observing travelers in so many places around the world? So here we go with our questions. You ready? Your favorite season to travel, Miss Elaine?
Well, I'm kind of a cool and cold weather lover, so I'm going to have fall. There's always so much happening in fall, if you think about it. But winter is a close second. I'm very much a snow chaser.
That is not what you normally hear from people.
I know. I am the contrarian.
Okay. And my favorite question, how many languages can you order beer in?
I think I say somewhere on my website, like 7, but it's probably more than that. Cause I give every language a try when I'm traveling somewhere. But my favorite for ordering beer is in Serbo-Croatian, and it's dva pivo molim, which is two beers, please. And if someone out there is from those countries, let me know if I pronounced it right.
In fact, you say you can order it in 12 languages.
Oh, 12. Okay, yeah. I knew I was undershooting.
Okay. And what is a little known fact about your travel skills?
Oh, that's sort of hard. I'm kind of an avid map reader.
Ugh.
Might be surprised to know that there's an atlas living on my dining room table at all times. I guess My little known skill might be, if needed, I can live out of a very small backpack for a week. I can make it last. I can work it.
I am so jealous of that. But you are, so reading maps, if you're lost, grab a lane. And you also say that you're great at puzzle solving. How would that help when you travel?
Okay. Routes, right? And you run into stuff. You always need to have a plan B when you're traveling. Oh my gosh, what about all the delays? Yeah. I think it really helps. It helps to have that creative, like, okay, we're switching gears now. This didn't work.
Try something. Okay. I'm adding a question. What is on the horizon, an up and coming travel destination that you have your eyeball on? What are you most excited about? Or maybe a couple.
Oh my gosh. So that's an interesting question because for so long that was my focus. And then of course I wasn't allowed to go anywhere. And now I'm traveling within the United States. And so I've been looking for things just in the United States that surprised me. I have a piece in the New York Times this weekend on the Sky Island Mountains of southeastern Arizona,
oh my gosh,
biodiverse. So I've been looking for places in the United States that just surprise people. In terms of foreign destinations, I've been really dying to get to Haida Gwaii, which is in Canada. I think it used to be called Queen Charlotte Island.
Oh yeah.
The Galapagos of the North. And I'd really like to see that. Sounds rich. It's rich in First Nations culture as well. So that's on my radar for sure.
Well, let me tell you, Lynn, it should be. My girlfriend's a Haida Indian or however you say it now. She's Haida is how she says it. She lives in Hawaii and she is one of the most fun, energetic, positive, nutty, lovely gals I've ever known. And she tells me all about the Haida culture and it's beautiful and they're beautiful. Okay. So last but not least, what feat of travel are you most proud of accomplishing?
Yeah, I am not that traveler that like counts countries or anything like that. So I have to say, like, the thing that I'm most proud of is that I actually raised a child as a travel writer. I feel like travel gives you all those lessons that every parent wants their kid to have, like tolerance, curiosity, daring, and, you know, a basic appreciation for the beauty of the world. That's my proudest achievement.
Well, I'll tell you what, Elaine, you just keep it up because we need you. We need you out there encouraging us. You know, we love the Global Wellness Summit because they really make a goal of meeting in a different country each year. And I am so fortunate to have been to Mexico City, which I'd never been to, Morocco, where else with them? A little corner of Italy I would have never, Singapore. I mean, my life is so much richer and I meet people like you. So I can't even thank you enough for being on our show. I know our readers are dying to, or our listeners are dying to get out there and travel. So please keep shining the light for us, will you?
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Okay. See you soon on the road. This episode is brought to you by Murad Skincare and features an interview with Dr. Deepika Chopra, the optimism doctor, who also happens to be guest editor of Murad's new online magazine, Well Connected. Guess what, guys? Murad Skincare, founded by the legendary dermatologist Dr. Howard Murad in 1989 and now owned by Unilever, is the sponsor of this season's Global Wellness Summit podcast. Yep, we've hit the big time. Murad actually was one of the very first doctor-backed clinical skincare lines. And you know what? He's always been on the cutting edge of communication, all about skincare. You know, from infomercials in the 90s to a podcast today. And spoiler alert, I even get to guest host Murad's June podcast. Anyway, here's why this sponsorship is so perfect. Dr. Murad was really the first derm to make the mind-body-spirit connection to skincare. We all know now that good skin comes from the inside out, but it wasn't always that way. And guess how we're going to share Murad's message in each of our 6 episodes this season? We're interviewing 3 of their very cool, influential, and in the now guest editors for Murad's new digital wellness publication called Well Connected. Our first interview is with July's guest editor, the gorgeous, accomplished, and very compassionate Deepika Chopra. She's known as the Optimism Doctor, and she serves on Murad's advisory council. And she recently interviewed Dr. Murad for her podcast that's called Looking Up. It was such a meeting of the minds between two people who believe the adage, why have a bad day when you can have a good day? Deepika, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's so, so, so great to be with you.
Well, you know what? Your work has been featured in Forbes, Harper's Bazaar, Vogue, Goop, Variety, E, NBC, so many places. Would you mind summing up for us your work life and what you do in just a few sentences?
Yes. Okay. So I'm Dr. Deepika Chopra. My background is that I have a doctorate in clinical health psychology, but I've been studying and passionate about the science behind optimism, resiliency, and joy for over a decade now. And so my specialty is really blending together holistic-based practices with real evidence-based science and really helping people and large corporations come up with tools that are really based on your own resources. So it's really not about this, like having to purchase something really expensive or do some long retreat or anything other than what we have inside, and sharpen those skills and tools from our own resources to live a more resilient and optimal life.
Well, you know, that could not be more timely after we've made it through 2020. There's light at the end of the tunnel. But how does that motivate someone like you to be guest editor for Well Connected by Murad?
Well, I mean, when they reached out to me, I was nothing but excited. My mom actually used to use Murad when I was a little girl. And so I was very familiar with the brand. And I really only knew much about, you know, the brand through that. So I knew they were in skincare. I knew they were very rooted in science, which I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. But I only really got to know Murad and the Dr. Murad behind Murad by being honored to be involved with them. And when they reached out to me in a few different ways, yes, I'm on the council and I got to have Dr. Murad on an episode of my podcast. And yes, getting to guest edit the July features of Well Connected, I really got to learn so much more. And what I found was that we have so much in common and it makes so much sense. He's just such a pioneer in his field. And what I love about him so much, there's so much I love about him that I learned personally about him on the episode, but I love what I love about him in the brand wise is that he was so ahead of his time and knew, you know, at his core, how important the whole body and mind is. And it's not just about, you know, topical or aesthetic skincare. He really, like, you know, his notions and ideas about environmental stress, just that alone, and how, like, you can't just look at someone, his patient coming in and saying, all right, let's see your skin. Like, he had a bunch of follow-up questions always about their lifestyle and what was really going on. And so for me, obviously, in so many ways, personally, but professionally, I really respect that. And I was so excited to be on board.
Well, you know, his life story, his origin story is such a journey from immigrants, six children, no money. What about that story spoke to your mission of optimism?
I'm all things optimism. And I think I really have to first define what optimism really is. So I think a lot of people have this misunderstanding that optimism is really just about being positive all the time. And to be honest, optimism is not really about that. Optimism is much more closely related to concepts of resiliency and curiosity than it is to just blanket positivity. And so for me, it was so exciting. My whole podcast is about resiliency and about that. And so it was really, really exciting to hear. I was so inspired by his story because at the core of all of it is he's a very, very resilient man. And he comes from an extremely resilient family. And so it was just so inspiring to hear about not just his background, but his work ethic. Yeah. And, you know, like I oftentimes talk a lot about this idea of, you know, it's not just about wanting something and then like it falling into your lap, which I know that there's a lot of that going around these days on this idea of if you just want something and you think about it, it's going to fall into your lap if you just ask the universe for it enough. and there's like, you know, some, of course, there's aspects of that that I think are really important and I'm a believer of, but there's so much missing in that. You know, it takes hard work and it takes a mindset shift and it takes a lifestyle change. And I think he's just such a beautiful illustration of having a dream and having optimism and having a positive future directed thought process, even coming from where he came from, and then also having the work ethic and the motivation and the drive and the perseverance really and resiliency through struggle to actually make all of it happen and continue to make it happen. So he was just a great illustration and example of what we talk about on the podcast. It was a beautiful episode. It was one of my favorites.
Yeah. And I mean, to think his dad delivered things on a bicycle. His mother was a seamstress.
Yes.
This man, there's so many skincare lines too. I mean, there's just one a minute. And to have a skincare line with substance. So speaking of which, I'm looking at the stories you're working on as the guest editor for Well Connected. The theme is, of course, finding optimism everywhere. But there's categories like toxic positivity. What is that?
It's probably one of my favorite topics to discuss. And I think that it's always really somewhat like baffling to people that an optimism doctor talks about this idea that sometimes positivity can actually be not just detrimental, but actually toxic. And so I think it's something that we can all actually relate to, because over the past, I'd say really half decade, I think we've all been like pressured all the time to sort of like slap on like a positive bumper sticker on everything. And toxic positivity, the way that I define it, is really, it's this insincere notion of positivity that can actually lead to harm. And it's the disregard and actually the vilification of the normal range of human emotion.
Wow.
That we all actually, we are as humans, we are actually made to experience the full range of human emotion. And so if we're constantly being told that there's no space for anger, fear, frustration, sadness, grief, whatever, worry, whatever it is, we're really setting ourselves up and other people we love up for failure, because that's actually part of the human existence. And so It really is the opposite of validation and hope and the recognition of resiliency and examples. You've heard them everywhere, but examples of toxic positivity are like good vibes only. you'll get over it. Just be happy. It could be worse. You know, so I think these things, you know, while they come from a good place and a good intention, whether we're saying them to ourselves or to others, I think that we have to start like figuring out and thinking about our language, because they're actually hurting us more so. So, you know, it's this idea that we have to have a healthier form of positivity, and it has to be rooted more in sincere truth and empathy. And it should be towards ourselves or others, but it should really be, you know, providing support and validation for one's pain and acknowledging it and letting them lean in and sit there and just having a space to listen. But at the same time, you know, helping to lift others up and offering hope, you know, while making that full range of emotions, not just permissible, but actually normal. So it's really, you know, like, just positive or good vibes only is not a thing.
To wrap up our episode on travel, it is fitting that we flip the discussion from frugal or general travel to doing a bit of a deep dive into the world of luxury travel. We'll be talking to Jennifer Kester, the executive editor of Forbes Travel Guide, the same organization that gives 5 stars to worthy properties. Jen's been reviewing luxury hotels and travel destinations for Forbes since 2008, and her Instagram page, @jennifer.kester, is a dreamy jaunt through the best hotels in the world. Listen for her insights on how sustainability, slow travel, and prescribing nature are being woven into luxury experiences too, and even find out how a resort might earn the Oscar of Travel Awards, the Forbes 5 stars. Here we go. Well, now in our Travel Reset episode, we are so thrilled to have a major representative of the luxury travel space, and that is Jen Kester. She is the vice president and executive editor of the Forbes Travel Guide. So if you listeners out there have ever looked for Forbes 5-star properties, just know that Jen Kester has probably already been there ahead of you. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you so much, Kim. I'm so delighted to be here today.
Hey, so your Instagram bio says that you are a hotel-obsessed traveler, a journalist, a foodie, a culture vulture, and a tea addict. How fun is that? So tell us a bit about how you got into your career.
Sure. I actually started in the news side of the business. I really thought I was going to be, you know, covering breaking news and really focused on that. But then I started working for Time Out Chicago, which is part of the Time Out family that started in London and New York, a set of magazines. And I helped launch the publication. And while working for Time Out, I realized how much I loved telling people where to go, where to find the best food, where to find, you know, the best spas. And that was my favorite part of it, was recommending things to other people who were coming to Chicago. So from there, I started freelancing. I did some work for some Condé Nast publications, some online publications. And one of my freelance clients was what was then Mobile Travel Guide, which was the precursor to Forbes Travel Guide.
The Mobile Travel Guide, M-O-B-I-L-E.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I started freelancing for them when I was living in San Diego and writing and editing. And then it just sort of snowballed. And, you know, they haven't let go of me since.
Hey, I just have to say, at cocktail parties, when you say your job, I just have to tell you, people might just be a little bit jealous. So if you want to follow Jen on Instagram, it's jennifer.kester. And look at all the places she's been. The pictures just make me weep because we're all in the mood. So speaking of which, a lot of us were locked up, most of the world, and we know that travel and hospitality as industries were brought to their knees. Something that was one of the biggest industries and GDP contributors in the world really came to a screeching halt. So now you get to really experience that budding, that blossoming, that opening again of an industry that all of us benefit from and most of us dearly love. So Jen, tell us, how are you seeing that the pandemic has or will change luxury travel?
I think that the pandemic has really made us more mindful of how traveling is a gift and in numerous ways for the mind, the body, and the soul. And I think it's also given us a much deeper appreciation of those tried and true destinations that we have in our own backyard. So, you know, as everybody was locked down at home and forced to, you know, just hunker down, people started rediscovering places like upstate New York and Montana and Florida's Gulf Coast and realizing that we're quite lucky in the United States with all the beauty and the wonderful destinations that we have. And I think that's continuing.
Yeah. Now, have you seen that also there are new markets opening up or there's established markets that are just like getting the light shone on them? I see you post a lot about the Caribbean.
I definitely think as people have started venturing out more, luxury travelers have been looking to those gems right in our backyard. So the Caribbean, of course, Mexico, like Los Cabos has, you know, seen an influx of American luxury travelers, but also those places that, like I mentioned before, were always there and are always reliable, but maybe have been overlooked in the past, mm-hmm. like upstate New York. You know, people are flocking there and really taking in the mountain scenery and the fresh air and the wide open spaces and rediscovering beaches, you know, flooding Miami and enjoying the gorgeous sands there and the beautiful waters and, you know, the palm trees and all of that. So I think it's really, really shown a light on what beauty we have right next to us.
Without having to get your passport out. But that brings me, I was able to visit Hawaii at the end of March. And it helped. The big incentive was my son moved there. So of course I could visit him. But I was so tickled at how good I felt because I was vaccinated. Lucky enough, I got a very sophisticated test, you know, a COVID test before I left. And then we got our nose swab when we landed. It was, but you know, with that aloha spirit, they were just so welcoming. You're like, sure, no problem. But then the other thing people don't think about is everything, most everything is open air there. So
yes,
people's restaurants, their, you know, activities, and even their homes are rather open air. So I think what you're saying, Jen, is by opening our eyes and turning our heads, sometimes we see delight really within reach, right?
Absolutely. I think Hawaii is a perfect example of that, where, you know, like you said, it seems almost made for pandemic times, and everything is out in the fresh air, and there's, you know, the water, and there is that aloha spirit that's unique to Hawaii.
Yeah. So I also have read a lot, and Elaine Glusek, who we talked to first and wrote the research report called The Travel Reset that this episode is about, talked about the need now people's hearts are moved to leave a place better than you found it. Now, we know sometimes there's greenwashing and people just jumping on the bandwagon to do it, saying it, but are they really doing it? But how much are you seeing sustainability woven into new luxury resorts?
Sustainability is definitely a buzzword right now in the hospitality industry, and a lot of hotels are looking to incorporate more sustainable practices in everything from, you know, the bedding and the bathroom amenities to the experiences for guests. And, you know, funny you mentioned Hawaii, because I think that Hawaii has had this really great program. It's called Malama Hawaii. And Malama means take care. And the idea is that the Hawaii Tourism Bureau wants to inspire mindful travel by giving visitors an opportunity to do some voluntourism. So they've enlisted a bunch of hotels, like the Four Seasons Resort Maui at Wailea, will offer guests the opportunity to perhaps help with processing some historic artifacts and documents for some museums. And for doing so, you get a $250 credit to use at the hotel or the spa or wherever, or you can get an upgrade in your room. They've also done things like offer guests the chance to volunteer to do some shoreline debris monitoring and some cleanup work. And again, you get some perks, whether it's an upgrade or a credit to use. So I think it's really inspiring people to leave the destination a better place than they found it, and really making an impact in a meaningful way.
Well, I read a lot too about resort companies making an effort to showcase local artisans or craftsmen, like the dishes in the room, the soap in the room. What are you seeing?
Definitely. I definitely think that hotels are looking to incorporate local whenever possible. So I've seen the Viceroy Hotel in the Riviera Maya has a soap butler who will come to your room and have these huge chunks of locally made soap, and you get to pick whichever one you want, and he'll slice you a bar, which is really fun and nice. And it's a nice fragrance souvenir for when you head home.
Yeah, and keep each other clean. Now, all those little details make a difference, Jen. And this question might be obvious to some, but I think it's good to review. You're with Forbes Luxury Travel Guide. What can a Forbes 5-star award mean to a property?
Well, it's actually a really good question. The Forbes Travel Guide 5-star is considered to be the Oscar of the hospitality industry. And the way we look at a 5-star is, you know, the 4-star is the best. So that's really what a lot of hotels aspire to. But the 5-star is the best of the best. So it's the Meryl Streeps, it's the Michael Phelps, it's the, you know, that cream of the crop that is on a whole other level. To kind of give you an example of how hard it is to achieve that, you know, we have these incognito inspectors who visit each of these properties. They stay there for 2 nights, 3 days, and they use up to 900 objective stringent standards. And the hotels have to obviously measure up, and they test everything. But 75% of the hotel's rating is based on service, and 25 is based on facilities, because really, wow, what we think is, it's, you know, there's a lot of beautiful places out there, But what will really make your experience stand out is the service, is the people who help you. Those are the components that really make a stay transformative.
That's right. Totally agree with that. Now, do you think it's possible that those beyond the uber rich or travel journalists or PR people like you and I can ever experience a five-star resort? Are there ways to make that happen?
Absolutely. I actually think that our ratings are even more important for those who aren't uber rich, because you know, you really, when you have saved up your money for a vacation or an experience, you don't want to waste it on someplace that pretends to be a five-star or that says it is and really doesn't deliver. So I think we can help those people really make use of their money and their time. And it doesn't have to be a hotel stay. It could be things like getting a cocktail at the bar. I mean, that's one of my favorite things to do at a luxury hotel, because it's another level. You get the ambiance, you usually get an amazing view, and you get a delicious cocktail to, you know, just wind down the day. There's also, you can take the chance to go and do a high tea at a hotel, which is a really fun way to experience the service there and enjoy some delicious tea and handmade confections and, you know, all those goodies. And of course, I'm always an advocate of trying the spa. You know, you can always go and get a massage. You can get a facial, have a girl's spa day. You can, you know, have a mother-daughter day. I mean, the possibilities are endless. And it's just one of those memorable experiences that people can have.
You remind me of two things. You know, my girlfriend and I were, I guess, 19 or 20. I don't know, when we went to 20 countries in 40 days or something all around Europe with the Eurail pass. But her mother had taken her on a five-star trip before that. And she and I were paying our own way. So what we do is sleep overnight on the train for free, right? And then wake up and go to a city to the five-star hotel and have breakfast, because that's pretty affordable. You can
absolutely. And it's a lovely experience. You know, you get the excellent service, you get delicious food and beautiful surroundings. And so there's always ways to steal a little bit of luxury.
Yeah. And I used to work with Tahiti a lot in Bora Bora. Of course, the St. Regis and the Four Seasons were the most expensive. So what I would do is hitch a ride with a friend on a boat to those resorts. And just like you said, get cocktails and appetizers, because I got to experience it. But speaking of spas, now, I was just looking at your Instagram post about the Rosewood Mayacobus five-star spa in the jungle. And that made me think, you of all people, could you tell us maybe the top five spa experiences you've ever had and the countries they were in?
Sure. Rosewood Mayacoba in Mexico is definitely among the top five. The spa sits on its own island filled with lush jungle, and each spa treatment room is like a villa, and they all circle this beautiful cenote. So after your spa treatment, you could just lounge amid the palms and take a dip in the cenote and just hear the birds.
What's a cenote?
A cenote is like a naturally made sinkhole, basically, with water in it, which is, there's a bunch of them in Mexico.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And they have indigenous Mayan treatments. It's just really unique there and really special.
Cool.
As far as other spas, one of my favorites is the spa at the Mandarin Oriental Hyde Park in London. They have this dark subterranean spa that makes you just want to curl up in a ball and just sleep and relax. And expert therapists, when I was there, they immediately honed in on my problem areas without me having to say anything. And it just was so relaxing. It's just sort of this oasis in the middle of the city. I actually just came back from Hawaii myself, and I went to Sensei Lanai, which is on the island of Lanai, and the spa there is unparalleled. It has these amazing spa halls that are basically standalone spas. Each one has a sauna, it has a set of outdoor onsen pools, it has an Ofuro soaking tub inside, and these oversized massage beds, and all of it is like nestled in tropical foliage. And you could have an entire spa experience within the confines of this hale. It's pretty spectacular.
So that's Larry Ellison's new wellness themed resort off of Maui on Lanai. Okay. Got that one.
Another one that really impressed me was the spa at Encore Las Vegas. I remember walking into this gilded space with these gold glowing Moroccan lamps leading to the treatment room. And of course, I had a wonderful treatment. I had an excellent massage. Mm-hmm. But what really also struck me was, I know this is really little, but it made such a big difference. When I was finished with my massage, the therapist handed me my robe and she put it in a warming tray. So that when I got off of the massage table, I felt like the experience didn't stop. You know, and it's just this pampering element. It's a thoughtfulness that not a lot of people think about, but it made it so that my spa experience continued. And I really appreciated that.
You're making us salivate, Jen. Keep going.
I would say for my last one, I would pick the spa at Montage Los Cabos in Mexico. Mm. The spa is enormous. It's around 40,000 square feet. It's, I think, one of the largest, if not the largest, in the Baja California Peninsula. And it's just very, very accommodating. So you go into your spa treatment room and you basically have a living room there where you can relax and you can lay down, you can go to the fountain, however you want to spend it. And I had a treatment there that left me smelling so good that I just like would sniff my arm, you know, throughout the day. And I just smelled amazing. I couldn't get over it. But they really provide a thoughtful experience. So they stock the spa in the locker rooms with like this huge selection of beauty products, from shaving creams and gels for men to makeup for women, which makes it really fun to kind of partake in that. Right. And there's this sprawling adults only pool that sits in the middle of it. And it's just so inviting. And you could just spend the day sleeping by the pool or relaxing, swimming, whatever, however you feel. And you can't help but leave there and feel just utterly relaxed and revitalized.
Yeah. I say like a piece of tenderized meat.
Yes.
You remind me, I love how you're so ecumenical. You go everywhere. It's not like you're a city girl or a, you know, jungle girl. Nope. You're equal opportunity luxury experience. I remember once having a business meeting in London, and because we work in the spa industry, there was a spa director that I'd only met in meetings, and he said, come and see our spa. And it was underneath, I'll look up the name, I was trying to find it, underneath Piccadilly Circus. So all this cacophony up above us with double-decker buses and, you know, horns honking and all of it. And he said, you have to meet our Watsu guy. He's so magical. And I love Watsu, which is like an underwater massage. So not only do you go under all that noise and you're in some serene little, I don't know, basement oasis. It had a big, huge pool and a Watsu corner, which means the water is really much warmer. And you could hear the tube, you know, the subway going up, but didn't matter. As he, you know, massaged my body underwater and worked it, somehow he played those singing bowls that vibrate.
Yes.
And it goes through your bones. And when you do it around water, it's so much more important. And at one point, I felt a heart beating. And I said, is that my heart or yours? Because that's how the sound and the water and he cried, you know, because he's like, no, we've done it. So yeah, there are such magical experiences that people are really trying to, you know, there's sort of a one-upmanship in this wellness thing, right? Like, where can you fly in on a parasail and have a massage between boulders on a beach or whatever, right? It's pretty crazy. So now I also saw that you wrote about something called a workcation. What the heck is that? And what does it mean?
Well, when the pandemic broke out and people were forced to stay at home and many people were instructed to work from home, it really created this large virtual workforce. And hotels are really creative. And what they decided to do was take advantage of the situation and basically say, if you can work remotely, why not do it someplace beautiful and scenic? And so they came up with some really innovative offerings. Like the St. Regis Aspen had a Zoom stylist who would go and do your hair in your room. Unfortunately, you know, I didn't have one access to the stylist before this podcast, but
me neither.
but just really creative things like that. And they would have, you know, like a Google Nest internet booster or enhanced lighting, all those things that you would need for your Zoom calls. And then they would do fun things like, okay, we'll deliver coffee in the morning and then cocktails in the evening. And then after work, you can participate in all these wonderful activities at our resort. So I think it was really a way to lure people to take these mini vacations so that they could indulge a little bit with, you know, a beautiful location or a really luxurious property, but still get their work done. The Ritz-Carlton Orlando and Grande Lakes had a business butler who would take care of all of your office needs, basically act as an assistant. And then they offered this ranger who would go and take your child and, you know, go off and have some fun with him or her and enjoy. So it's sort of a weird trend, but, you know, given the circumstances, I think that it's something where people were really eager to travel and this gave them an opportunity to do so.
Well, you know, I've been in travel so many years and, you know, the luxury dilemma is, do you take someone, you know, in a hermetically sealed plane to a place and drop them off in a hermetically sealed experience in this bubble away from the country itself and just serviced by the people there? And it's not how anyone else lives, but also sometimes that can be depressing. You know, if you go out among the townsfolk, you're like, why am I spending, you know? So tell me, do you think slow travel or prescribing nature, you know, tying in the surroundings, getting people out among the destination features, is that a trend in luxury travel as well?
I definitely think it is. And I think it's something that was true even before the pandemic. Travelers were really seeking authentic experiences and they want to go beyond just the, okay, we're here in Paris, you know, there's the Eiffel Tower. That's great. You know, but they want something deeper and more meaningful. So I think hotels and destinations are looking for ways to give travelers a tie to that area. So one example would be El Encanto, a Belmont hotel in Santa Barbara, started doing these coffee tours, showing people this coffee farm, the only one in Santa Barbara, and, you know, giving them a chance to meet the people who are growing the coffee and, you know, meet the animals that are on the farm and then obviously enjoying some coffee on the way. So it doesn't have to be something, you know, really big, like you were saying, you know, like parasailing to a boulder and, you know, and doing all of that. It could just be more of a simple experience of meeting the locals and learning what is native to the area and, you know, what is the food that you're eating, who made it, who grew it, who, you know, helped procure it. And, you know, or simple as going and doing a farm tour of a coffee farm and meeting the growers there.
Yeah. Well, you know, you make me remember so many great memories. I've just been so lucky to travel, not as much as you, but quite a bit, and spending a lot of years in Hawaii and 12 years working with Tahiti. What you walk away with are certainly gorgeous views and amazing water and all that, but it's the people. It's those interactions. I'll just share one story that will mean something to you. A travel writer was with us visiting, and she was going out on the, it was called a lagoon safari in Bora Bora, where you could swim with sharks and snorkel over coral and pet stingrays and all this. And I looked at her and she had a bunch of diamond rings on her hand. And in the boat as we were tootling out. And I said, honey, are you going to wear your jewelry? Do you know, swim around? And she said, oh, I never take it off. It's my wedding rings of 30 years or whatever. So anyway, as we were done with our amazing day and tootling back, I saw the rings weren't there. I said, oh, so you did take them off. She goes, what? They had come off in the water somewhere.
Oh, no.
So of course that could really ruin your trip, but she tried to be a good sport about it. And we actually went on to the next island, to the next hotel. And while we were there, we got a fax, that's how long ago it was, from the GM of the Bora Bora Hotel that showed a shark's mouth. And inside the mouth were her rings. It was all made up. What really happened was our lagoon safari guide, which was a family, said, oh, we can't have anybody be sad. And they went back out to the coral reef and snorkeled around and found her rings.
Wow.
Got them for her. Now that's something that, you know, that is like service beyond, right?
Absolutely.
And they didn't pay for that. That was just really from the heart. So those are the kind of experiences. Jennifer, we could talk to you so long and hear all your experiences, but you know, during the pandemic, we've all thought about, you know, life and death clearly, and what does life mean? So the bucket list, the idea of a bucket list has come up so much. So if you were going to give somebody three things to make sure they try while they're on this earth, what sort of travel experiences would you recommend?
That's hard. I guess, you know, for me, it would really depend on what kind of person it is. But I would definitely, since we were talking a lot about Hawaii, I would probably recommend a visit there. There's something about that aloha spirit and the people in Hawaii that's just so special that you don't see it anywhere else in the US. Mm-hmm. And I personally had a very wonderful experience when I was at the Four Seasons Hualalai on the Big Island. I did one of those native canoe tours with, it was just me and two guides, and there were dolphins all around us. And my heart almost burst because there was a baby dolphin and I was able to just like easily jump off the side of the canoe and snorkel next to the baby dolphin and see it. And it just also gave me a deeper appreciation for nature and, you know, the frailty of it, because behind us, there was like this big ferry, and obviously that's not great for, you know, the mammals and other underwater creatures. So just experiencing that and seeing how precious life is, really, it really stuck with me. So I would recommend Hawaii and doing something similar to that. Another one, you know, St. Lucia is a special destination too in the Caribbean. And for adventurous people, there's places like Jade Mountain where the accommodations only have three walls. Mm-hmm. So your fourth wall is basically a TV screen of the pythons, and they're looming right there. And you get, you know, you can just see them from your bed. You could see them from your bathtub. Oh, you can see them from the swing in your room. And it's just one of those bucket list type experiences that I think you have to do just once because it's so over the top and different.
Okay. And then I think for Europe, a lot of people do the tried and true. They do the Eiffel Tower, you know, Big Ben in London, whatever. But I always encourage people to, you know, open their horizons, open their minds. I was able to visit Istanbul. I was so delighted with that opportunity. And I really felt like, you know, I had forgot to turn my head a certain direction my whole life. I never, ever heard morning prayers. You know, when you wake up at 3 or 4 and they're singing that beautiful dirge and you can hear it in the air like birdsong. And then the food, oh my God,
yes.
I could have some of that cheese right now. And the people are so dynamic. But anyway, have you been anywhere in Asia that you think is really,
you know,
surprising?
When you were talking about Istanbul, I actually immediately, what flashed in my mind was Thailand.
Yeah.
Just because it also has, the people there are so warm and open and welcoming, mm-hmm. in a way that I think is unique to the destination. And, you know, Bangkok, its roads are just like clogged and there's these little tuk-tuks that are weaving in and out. And it's kind of crazy busy, but there's such a a warmth to Thailand, and the best massages are there as yes. well, I have to say.
Yes. And they're rather affordable. But you
and
know,
the food is top notch. The food is like so fresh and delicious.
And Janet, we wouldn't be serving purposes well if we didn't really with you talk about the wonder of hotels in a city. What role do you think great hotels play in a destination? What's their role?
I think a great hotel is a hub of the community. They encourage people to come and gather at their bar, at their restaurant. They also engage the community. They employ artists to come and do things. They employ dancers and singers, and they really embody what the city is. They embrace all the traditions and cultures and share that with guests.
Right. I tell you, they really are beacons, and the Grand Dome hotels are really symbols of each city. So I guess our message is hug your local hotelier. They've been through a lot this year.
Absolutely.
And they need our support. Well, Jen, we have to stop ourselves. We could go on and on, but thank you so much. And we're going to be following you, Jennifer Kessler, on Instagram. We're going to be salivating about all your experiences, but keep shining the light, because we're going to follow you. And we're going to...
Thank you.
We're going to Forbes travel guide it, okay?
Thank you so much, Kim.
Okay, it's our pleasure.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of the Global Wellness Summit podcast. I tell you, I feel like after this episode on travel, I'm going to run upstairs, pack a bag, and jump in the car and go anywhere. I am not kidding. I have missed it. Have you? I've missed it so much. And I can't wait till everybody's vaxxed up and we're hugging each other again and supping and sharing great experiences. A special thanks to our brilliant guests, Elaine Glusak from the New York Times and Jennifer Kester from Forbes Travel Guide. What an information-packed episode. Don't forget, everyone, to check out the Global Wellness Summit website, because there you'll find upcoming masterclasses, research and trend reports, and of course, news on the next summit. This is Kim Marshall, co-founder of Swell Public Relations, signing off. Can't wait to get together again.